Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
What's up? Welcome back to Barton and Buds. We are recording here on Sunday morning. A few things came up. Monday morning. Missed our Sunday night recording. We are fresh off the playoff announcements. We got Clark Lee is the new head coach at Vanderbilt. We got Auburn seems to be narrowing things in their head coaching search. We've got playoff debates. We're gonna go a little. We're not gonna talk playoff matchups today, right? But we're gonna go a little more big picture on just a few of the things that have been sort of the bugs in our heads right now that we want to get out. So how are you? How was your big playoff reveal party? Was it as suspenseful as you'd hoped it would be?
It was great, man. I had a tweet go semi-viral, pointed out that
A&M... What was your tweet? I didn't see that. What was your viral tweet?
A&M had more wins over teams which fired its coach than it did over teams with winning record.
Oh, those Aggies have got on your ass for that one, didn't they?
Yeah, Lucci was loving that. And it is what it is. I think the BCS really could have taken care of this year, to be honest. Like, if you just said, hey, we're going to fast forward and we're going to play Clemson, Bama. That seems to me like the two best teams. The issue this year was just figuring out that fourth team.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just start here. And I know you have some thoughts on this, and I don't want to steal your thunder on this. So I'll cede the floor to you and kind of let you go where you want with this. I will say, as a sort of a disclaimer, and I think, I don't know, I'm not sure if this is where you're going or if you agree with this, but like, I am, and I think this year hammers it home for me as much as any. I am very much in favor now of an 18 playoff. I've had some indifference about it in the past, but something about this cycle has pushed me to the side of very much of the belief an 18 playoff is necessary. And there's a few reasons for that. We can get into it, but we were talking about this a little before the show, so I don't want to steal your thunder here, but where would you take this discussion?
So I'm a little bit worried about the sport of college football, right? I think this year, I don't want to call it a sham of a year, but certain elements of it to me were kind of, you know, sham-ish. And it really kind of exposed this is really a business. And we know it is. But we have to kind of keep up the facade that everybody has a chance and that everybody needs to be interested in this sport. And I think you have some problematic things happening. We are not going to have a national champion from west of the Mississippi River for the 15th year in a row. 05 Texas was the last team to do that. The Pac-12 hasn't made it into the playoff in what, the last 4 years? You know, you have Cincinnati, which these aren't opponent adjusted numbers, but they're still pretty good. Number one defense in the country and a top 20 offense, you know, really unchallenged for the most part this year. They go undefeated. They don't have a shot to get in under the current system. I think for the good of the sport, and to keep this sport a sport that is nationally relevant and that people care about across the country, we need to keep up the idea, if not the reality, that everybody has a shot to win the title if they do what they're supposed to do. If they take care of business, they go undefeated, if they're a dominant team. And I think that would keep more interest throughout the sport nationally. I worry that this sport is becoming too regional in terms of interest. It's been regional in terms of dominance for a long time, but ultimately I think that weighs on things. And if you at least allow people to get into the dance by going to an 8-team playoff. And I don't say that because I think there are 8 teams that can win the title. In fact, this year, I think if that's the reason why you're going to an 8-team playoff, if you think we actually have 8 teams that can really win it, I strongly disagree with you. I think this year we have probably the least number of teams who could legitimately win it in quite a while. But I think it's about keeping that belief alive in fans. It would also bring, I think, a little bit more drama to some of these playoff weekends with auto bids. If you have like an upset champion in some of these conference championship games, assuming, of course, that we would put some kind of thing into where, like, even if you win the conference, you have to be in the top 15 as well to get in. That way we don't have, you know, some team with 5 losses getting in just because they won the league. But it would also, you would probably have to play these opening round games on campus, which brings a little more of the collegial feel to it. And it gives you incentive to continue to play really, really well down the stretch. You can't just coast because you're going to want to get that game against the number 8 seed, right? Like Bama's going to want to play Cincinnati or whomever the at-large is, and they're going to want to play them in Tuscaloosa. So they're going to keep their starters, and they're going to keep playing, you know, really hard. I don't think they're just going to start to coast and not care. So I do think 8 makes more sense here, and I used to not be an 8 guy, but I'm just worried about this sport, man, as far as people's interest in it.
100%. I agree with everything you're saying there. And 8 is the number more so than 6. I used to be like, all right, we're going 4, all right, maybe you go to 6. Because here's the thing. You're right. There's only 2 teams that can win the national championship this year, barring something crazy, barring a huge shock. And so getting to 8 is not about including all the potential national champions. It's just about broadening the interest and broadening the conversation beyond the 4. And so if you go 8 and you have 5 conference champion auto bids, then the conference championship race is significantly more interesting throughout the season. If Northwestern upsets Ohio State and Northwestern gets the Big Ten auto bid, then just like the NCAA tournament, that all of a sudden creates this conversation about, well, who is Ohio State getting that large bid? Who are they bumping out? Northwestern has something to play for. Iowa or whoever is contending for that Big Ten West opportunity has something to play for. There's just a lot more season-long, you know, intrigue to sort of keep people invested. 100% first round of those games are on college campuses. Whatever. Like, I don't know how the revenue works. I don't know, like, split the revenue however you need to, but just the collegiate atmosphere, the environment that would create, a playoff game on a college campus would be bonkers. Like, would be awesome. Let's do it. And so, you know, there's plenty of economic benefits that a college town would receive. Yeah, again, share the gate, whatever you need to do on that front, do it. But get it on a college campus. And you're right. The idea that like Alabama playing Cincinnati as a 1-8 or whoever it would be as some throwaway game. Look, that's Alabama. It's important to get that 1 seed. Because you're probably going to play a G5 team and you're probably going to get an easy first round game, and really no one else is getting an easy first round game. And so there is real, like, seeding is very important, especially if the first 4 seeds are getting a home game as opposed to the 5-8. So it's not about like, oh, the 5th best team. Should have, like, A&M got screwed, they should have gotten in. Cincinnati got screwed, they should have gotten in. Like, those teams aren't good enough to win a national championship this year. I'm not really like crying tears for them as much as I just want this thing to be more inclusive and be a sport where you are winning it on the field. Like yeah, Cincinnati has no shot at being Bama, but let's let them decide that. Let's let Cincinnati like prove one way or the other, or let's let Bama prove one way or the other. They have no shot at beating them. Like, let's decide it on the field instead of this farce, sham, shamocracy. What is it? These guys who are sitting in that conference room with the windows drawn, watching games on TV, a big screen TV. Like, give me a break, man. Like, let's just take the people out of it. Conference champs, you got two at-large bids. So you can have the committee if you want to, I guess. Whatever. But I've over the last 36 hours, I've become totally convicted in this idea. I think it was driven by the picture of the guys in the playoff committee watching the game. It's like, get those guys out of here.
They missed a tremendous marketing opportunity to not have like Broyhill or Lazy Boy or somebody come in there with some serious recliners and allow these folks to be posted up in the recliner watching the game. Like, who is going to sit in that ballroom chair for 9 hours watching the game? Like what are you trying to prove to us? Like, you're flying down here for this Spartan existence? I had to sit in the chair on the anchor desk in Lauderdale, and I was a hell of a lot more comfortable than that for 8 or 9 hours on signing day, just like you did. Can you imagine sitting in a ballroom chair for 9 hours?
They look like hostages. They look like that. Being on the playoff committee, if that's what you have to do every weekend, sit in a room with no windows, 6 feet apart at conference, with no food, no drink in there, just hotel ballroom with big screen TVs. It sounds terrible. With a bunch of old athletic directors. Sweet life.
Oh, so bad.
I used to dream of the opportunity. Like, it sounded so awesome to be on the College Football Playoff Committee until I found out that's what it is.
So I have a confession to make. We had to write our predictions for the games, for the playoff games. We had to send them to Chris Hummer. He tabulated them and put them all together. For the Alabama Notre Dame game, I actually wrote mine before they made their announcement. I think you might have saw this, but I just put the word Notre Dame /Texas A&M in there because they're really pretty similar teams to me in terms of style. I wrote, I'll take Alabama by 3 scores. Nick Saban's teams almost never lose to teams which are unable to repeatedly win one-on-one matches on the outside. And Notre Dame /Texas A&M does not have dangerous threats at the receiver position. In fact, the most dangerous pass catching threats for the Irish /Aggies are the tight ends. That won't get it done against Alabama. I'd expect Notre Dame /Texas A&M to try to slow the game down, limit possessions. But ultimately, this is Alabama hitting home runs and Notre Dame /A&M hitting singles and doubles, which honestly, I stand by that. I think that they're not explosive, and they both have good defense, and they're going to try to run the ball and slow the game down. But I do want to bring this up. I was a little bit wrong here. Notre Dame is not lacking for explosiveness through the air in the same way that A&M is. Like, they're not explosive, but they're not that level of not explosive. So the Irish were 69th in Bill Connolly's passing explosiveness ratings. Texas A&M was 108th. And I went back and looked at this. So here are their rankings in passing explosiveness since Jameis. This is not A&M's rankings. These are the rankings for Jimbo since he had Jameis. So 2015 to now. 78th, 63rd, 61st, 97th, 118th, 108th. And I don't know that this offense is less explosive now than it used to be. Like, is it really that much worse the last 3 years than it was the prior three? I have a hard time thinking that. I just think the rest of the sport has found it easier to get more explosive because they're designing shot plays and using the RPO game better. And A&M is still running what they've been running. And they're very, very, very good in other areas. But this is, I think, just relative to the rest of the sport, they're less explosive through the air than they used to be. And that's an issue.
Yeah, I think the sport has changed, and Jimbo hasn't really. Not in a significant way. But that is, I've thought for a while that Notre Dame and A&M team were very similar, both in the way they won and just sort of the, you know, the teams they beat, honestly, the resume even is similar in a lot of the ways. And then even at the quarterback position, they kind of have similar skill sets. Defensively, I mean, they've got defensive coordinators that are from the same tree, like they're running the same stuff. Like they're very similar, and then defense being the strengths really of both teams. And look, the A&M thing with them not getting in the playoffs, like they're missing an opportunity for a rematch with a team it got beat by 28 by, you know, and so at least in that sense, you know, you can understand the argument of, all right, Notre Dame did get a win over Clemson. Notre Dame's about to play an Alabama team that they're 20 point underdogs to, but they're going to get a shot that A&M's already had at one point. So, but I thought that was a good observation by you. And I do think it's more representative of the way I don't think that Jimbo Fisher has gotten less explosive through the years. I feel like everyone else has gotten more explosive. And he's just sort of content chugging along.
In fairness, we should also note they had some injuries and some opt-outs at the receiver position, you know, early in the year, which is impacted. Like I don't think they would be 108th if they had their full complement of receivers. I'm just not really confident they'd be, you know, top third of explosive just based on what we've seen. So we'll have to see how that offense evolves there in College Station. I want to float something by you. Is there any way you think a G5 team could get into the college football playoff under the current setup?
100% no. No, I don't think so, but I will allow you to state your case on how it is possible. On what in fantasy land would allow a G5 team to get in?
So is that because you don't think they're good enough, or because you think it's rigged, or both?
I think that the subconscious bias, I don't think it's rigged in the sense where like they are going, where there's even implicitly any sort of mandate to keep the G5 out. But I think that each individual going into that room, and part of it is based on, you know, in the way that committee is constructed and the human beings that it is constructed with all come from essentially a Power Five background. And so, again, I don't think that it is, you know, intentional in any way, but I think that the subconscious biases they bring in are such that it would be very, very difficult for one, much less a collective of them, to come to the conclusion that a G5 team is better than a Power Five team, unless there was just an perfect storm. So I guess rigged, but only in a very like unintentional subconscious sort of way.
I was really thinking about this. By the way, I
also probably agree with that subconscious. Like, I don't think a Group of Five team is good enough. And yet I understand the idea of like, who cares what I think, let it happen on the field. Which is why, again, back to the 18 playoff deal, but go ahead.
Right. I think, but I don't 100% know. I can't, right, 100% dismiss that they could, you know, win a one-off game, mm-hmm, et cetera. This is why I kind of agree with you. I think it's probably about 95% chance that they can't get one in. I think there's a very outside chance that something could happen where you get one in. And to me, there are two examples where this maybe could have worked. So in 2015, Houston won the American. It beat Oklahoma that year early on, got a lot of hype. Tom Herman, former national championship offensive coordinator, you know, really, really, really hot name. They had a big time quarterback, at least by college standards, and they were very exciting. You know, a defense that had a lot of playmakers on it. They go 13-1. They win. They beat Florida State in the New Year's Six Bowl. They start the next year ranked pretty high, right? They beat Lamar Jackson. I think that I think that there are some elements here where maybe I think the committee would be forced to put somebody in. And that would be, all right, the team has a tremendous year the year prior. They you know, beat Power Five teams convincingly. They do it in the New Year's Six Bowl. That they really show, okay, like, guys, we belong. Thus, they start the next year really high. So they have that kind of initial poll bias in their favor as opposed to against them, like it normally is. Then I think that they have to absolutely ragdoll their conference, basically in a way that they are just like dismissive of their own league and say, guys, we are doing to our G5 league what you think a P5, like a top P5 team would do to this G5 league. But we're winning games by an average of three or four scores. You know, we are not in jeopardy of losing in any of these games. And I think they probably need to have a marquee win over a P5 team in that year. If that Houston team that went 13-1 in 2015, if that Houston team in 2016 had run the table, I think it would have probably been too much to turn down. The thing is, they went 9-4. You know, but like if you go 13-1, you start the year in the top 10, you run the table, you go undefeated. I think that at that point, the committee might have looked around and said, man, if we don't put this team in, this really looks rigged. Cincinnati, on the other hand, this year is not a sexy team. You know what I mean? A lot of guys can't name any players on that team. Maybe they know Desmond Ridder.
But they put a little makeup on. Like they've got their prettiest dress out and they started, you know, the offense started going off. Like they were the old, like, you know, movie, a girl in overalls and pigtails and
she has her
makeover and goes to the prom and yeah, all that. She's all that. And then like they started playing some offense. And so I think by the end of the year the team was turning some heads walking down the sidewalk.
I just think you need to do that for like a full year, the year prior, so you can start higher. Like Cincinnati did not start high enough, I think, to be really considered by the committee, as crazy as that is.
So there's a couple things that I think need to be, like, it has to be a perfect storm. One, that, like, yes, I think they have to be coming off a year where there's this, you know, they get the early season bump. They walk into the season with some preconceived notions that they're really good. But UCF came off an undefeated season claiming national championships. And at whatever it was, 13-0 going into 2018. And they went undefeated in the regular season. They finished seventh. So I think that is important. But I also think, and look, UCF, like their game against North Carolina that year got canceled, though North Carolina at the time I don't think was ranked. So that was going to be a huge deal, but it was at least a Power Five team. But they beat Pitt 45-14. I'm sitting here looking at their schedule. They beat Pitt 45-14 that year. The only ranked team they played all of the year is Cincinnati, which they beat 38-10. So I think you do have to have the previous season success, but you also have to have, I think, Power Fives on your schedule, hopefully good Power Fives. And if you're a group of five team, like, you better take your game on the road. Like, don't sit there expecting people to come to you. Go out and earn it. So there's that. And then I think, you know, you just have to have a little bit of chaos elsewhere. So, but even with those three or four, if you just include sort of our general margin of victory and dominance within your conference, even if those four things are met, I still think you are counting on a lot of other help from around the country.
Yeah. I mean, look, your UCF example pretty much proves it. They met almost all those criteria, right? They beat Auburn in the bowl game the year prior. They started high in the rankings. They went undefeated. They won their conference. I guess the only thing it's missing is, you know, a dominant win over like a good P5 team. As you mentioned, UNC got canceled, but I think that was the year that Fedora got fired anyway, if I recall. And they probably played a few too many close games. You know, like the games that, not even single score, although 31-30 over Memphis was fairly close. I mean, 35-24 against Navy. I remember
that
one.
They were fortunate to win. They were fortunate to get out of that Memphis game alive. They really should have lost it if I remember
right. Yeah, and then they revenged them in the championship game, 56-41. This UCF example kind of helps drive it home because it really runs counter to my thought there. They meet almost all these criteria, which probably strengthens our argument for going to eight. It would help keep more fans engaged throughout the year. I think if they thought like, hey, we're going to root for the plucky underdog here. We're actually going to rally around this UCF team, as annoying as they were that year, the year prior, claiming that they were the national champions and all this stuff. Yeah, this is tough.
We're just out here trying to save the sport, bud. We're trying to save the sport of college football. I hope someone's listening.
I do worry about this a little bit, and I actually think I was listening to Jimbo talk around the golf cart one year at one of those Jimbo camps. And I think he did this in a press conference too, but he was talking about the importance of basically ACC teams playing FCS teams. And it's a self-serving argument for sure, because they do, and like the Big Ten does not play FCS teams. But he's making his point. Like, look, that one game is a huge chunk of their revenue every year. And when they play, like when that FCS team plays that game against that D2 school, that's a pretty good chunk of that D2 school's revenue for that year. And the point is, it's trickle down economics, which actually kind of works in college football, as flawed as this system is. And it trickles down to the high school level, is what he was saying. It's like, look, we can't have a system where we only have these 100 teams playing college football at the scholarship level. That hurts high school football. That's going to decrease high school football. We need to have these kids in high school football thinking they can go ahead and trickle up to college on scholarships, right? Not everybody's going to go get to play for Alabama or A&M or Florida. And we need to make sure that system stays healthy there. So I do worry about the sport sometimes. The model is certainly far from perfect.
I'm with you. Let's get it right. Should we take a break? Come back on the other side?
Yeah, I think so. Let's do that.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
If you want to win your fantasy football league, it starts right now. The offseason is the best time to get ahead of the competition. We'll help you win your league on the Fantasy Football Today podcast, part of CBS Sports Podcast Network. Fantasy Football Today has 3 episodes every week following the latest news, giving you early rankings, early sleepers, breakouts, and busts. So if you're a dedicated fantasy football manager, check out the most dedicated podcast, Fantasy Football Today. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found.
All right, guys, we are back. Barton, where do you want to go? You want to go Auburn search, Burt Bielema, Clark Lee, mailbag?
Let's mess around with these coaches a little bit. Let's start with who's already been hired. All right, so first we got Clark Lee to Vandy. Anyone that follows me knows that I am very much a believer in this hire. I watch introductory press conferences. I watch every single introductory press conference every year. It's like my pet project. And I would encourage people, anyone, any coach, anyone that's interested in like leadership, anyone that's interested in, college coaching and sort of, how to articulate a vision. Like I think Clark Lee's press conference is a textbook example of like how to approach a new place and articulate a vision and convey a level of like substance. So I'm a believer there. I think that's well known at this point. So I'm more interested. So anyways, watch the presser. If you're into that kind of thing, watch the presser. But Bud, I'll let you give your grade. What are our categories here? It's love it, get it, don't get it. So I'll go with the love it here. What's yours?
Yeah, we decided this year to stop giving letter grades because I don't think any of us have the ability to grade these coaching hires with that sort of accuracy. I can totally understand why you give Clark Lea the love it grade. And it is important to remember to grade these things on the curve of the job. I mean, Vanderbilt is coming off. They were probably the worst SEC team in my lifetime this year. They were 121st in offense, 118th in defense, and 118th in special teams on Connelly's rankings. I mean, they got nowhere to go but up unless you're going to get down to UConn territory, which is not going to happen. I think I don't want to fall into the trap of thinking that you understand the program and the culture is the reason why you're going to succeed. But I do think that inherently understanding the culture and the program and knowing sort of some of the challenges and who you need to go to get help in certain areas can help you avoid missteps and mistakes, which can torpedo you. So in some ways, I think that is a big draw of Clark Lea. He obviously played for them. He grew up there. He understands the culture and what Vanderbilt's about and what it's not about. And I want to grade this hire independent of the administration. Like, Vanderbilt has not really been known for supporting its football program compared to other SEC schools. Now there's word that it looks like it's, you know, wants to invest more. We'll see if those reports are accurate. I mean, I'm skeptical, but obviously that money they get from the SEC checks has got to go somewhere at some point, right? So I'm going to go with an I get it. I think Clark Lea is a really good defensive coach. He's a good recruiter, and I think he's a really good developer of talent. At the same time, we know it's just a fact that defensive recruiting rankings are better than offensive recruiting rankings. Offensive success is more dependent on coaching than defensive success is, because defense has a lot to do with height, weight, speed, and hustle. And it, not that scheme is not important, because it is. I think it's really important. But, you know, as Mike Leach proves, except for this year, I guess, and a lot of these guys prove, like, you can coach your way above your recruiting rankings on offense if you run a system, recruit to a system, et cetera. We don't see, like, top 20 level defenses in college football with, like, top 60 level recruiting. But we do see it much more often on the offensive side of the ball. So I'm going to go with a get it, because he understands the culture and for the reasons I listed. But his success at Vandy is in large part going to be, can you do something that is, I think, pretty outside the box on offense? Because you got to be a special prep.
So
I think
there's certainly a strong case to be made for that. I would argue, though, like, there is this narrative that, like, oh, if Vanderbilt isn't running, like, the triple option or something, they're like, they got no, you know, or some, you know, counterculture offense, then they're just not going to have success in the SEC. And I think, and obviously the idea is they're going to be at a talent deficit. My only argument against that is when you look at the programs that, based on their academic challenges that you would assume would be at a talent deficit, are primarily Stanford and Northwestern are the ones that have had success. And they've had success by being anything but sort of a counterculture. They've had success by playing great defense, controlling the clock, shortening games, being tougher and more disciplined, winning close games. And you know, there's other examples of teams like that, whether it be, I mean, Iowa State has started to be a little bit more different on both sides of the ball than, you know, maybe some of those teams. But like Michigan State sort of tries to win in that same mold. I know that Michigan State and Vanderbilt, comparing the way those two teams are capable or can recruit or do recruit, is sort of very much apples to oranges. But I do think that the idea that success at a place like Vanderbilt is dependent on like a funky scheme. I'm not sure I agree with that. I understand your point, but I do think that there are examples of programs that win with that sort of like with the Vanderbilt sort of obstacles in much more traditional ways.
So I see your point there, but I would also point out that I think the divisions in which Stanford and Northwestern play are different than the sure. atmosphere that which Vanderbilt like nobody recruits defense as a conference like the SEC. And so I think that you don't have to run something incredibly funky at Vanderbilt, but I think it needs to be something to where it requires a bit of special prep. And you need to catch, like, in order to get SEC wins under Clark Lee, you're going to have to play really good defense, right? You're going to have to be disciplined. You're going to have to develop the hell out of players. You're going to have to find some diamonds in the rough and win your battles locally for kids who, you know, maybe, like, you're going to have to go down to Atlanta and get some of those kids at Stanford and Notre Dame pull out of Atlanta, right? Who are high academic kids, like a Kyle Hamilton, right? Now, you're not going to get Kyle Hamilton over Notre Dame, even if you have Clark Lee, probably. I mean, unless he has a special relationship with the kid already or something. But those type of kids, right? The type of really high academic kid that gets plucked out of the Atlanta area or Nashville or Charlotte or whatever. You know, it's like, look, man, you don't have to go out to Stanford. Vandy's a really good school. You know, you went to Yale. Obviously, you understand the draw of the high academic nature there. But I do think you need to catch people sleeping with what you run on offense to where if they don't take you seriously during the week, Vandy can catch them for a win. I think if you're running an offense that relies on you beating people physically, as much as other SEC teams rely on beating people physically offensively, I think that's problematic because I don't know that even if you do a really good job recruiting there, is Vandy able to get that level of talent? Maybe it is. I that's why I'm going with it. I want to see who he hires on offense.
Sure. All right. Next up, Brett Bielema, Illinois. Love it. Get it. Don't get it.
I was gonna go don't get it, but I can't. I have to go with get it. I don't love it. Again, this is like we just talked about Vandy, and I don't want to compare Illinois and Vandy because Vandy's had more success as a program, I think, kind of recently with Franklin, but Bielema runs an offense that is absolutely contingent on pushing people around. And Illinois generally has the worst roster in the Big Ten West. And he's not known as an amazing recruiter. So I don't really know. What has he learned with his time with the Patriots and you know with where he's been and shadowing people? We saw him at a place with a talent deficit relative to the rest of the league at Arkansas. And he went 11-29 in the SEC, one winning year in the SEC at 5-3. I mean, even if you take out that 0-8 in year one coming off Petrino, it's still not pretty. Is he using kind of overdog tactics in an underdog situation? Because if so, that usually ends really badly. But he's a name. He's a big name, and that's apparently what their AD wants.
So I think like college football is can be so cruel because Brett Bielema has turned into such a meme. Like he's almost like this sort of kind of a running joke, like almost, you know, and very much in the same mold as like Butch Jones has or had become. And so When you look, I get it. He was 11-29 in the SEC, but that was in the SEC West, and that was like really at the height of SEC West dominance too, in terms of just like how good that division was playing at the time. You know, Dan Mullen was at Mississippi State, LSU was LSU, Alabama's Alabama, Auburn, you know, was a playoff contending at that point. So like this is a coach that has had success at Wisconsin, significant success at Wisconsin, He had, and what, he won three Big Ten championships at Wisconsin. He had, and really, like, he had Arkansas heading in the right direction early in his tenure. I think he got away from it a little bit when he lost some of that identity offensively, and they kind of started, like, they were a little bit of the team that he was recruiting big offensive linemen. Sam Pittman was his offensive line coach. They were really developing strong at that position. It was sort of this destination spot for big uglies, and they kind of had some good things going. And then it just started to turn south, and they lost their identity. And Dan Enos was their offensive coordinator and throwing it around 40 times a game. And you kind of forgot who they were a little bit, but all that to say is, so I'm on the get it camp. Because I think you, like, initial response is, oh, Brett Bielema, like, you know, he had like a reality TV show or something for a minute. And like, he's kind of goofy in press conferences. And like, he's just like, there's this aura that's grown around him. That's kind of not coaching, not football stuff. But if you really look at what his resume and what he's accomplished, I do think that there is stuff there that makes you think, like, this is a good hire for Illinois. The thing that for me, in looking at this job opening, like, I still think Lance Leipold is a stud that would, like, be really good at a Power 5 gig. And so I'm a little, like, the reason I don't love picking Brett Bielema over Lance Leipold, but I do get it, and I do understand the pick, and I think he's got a chance to be successful. I think there might be maybe a lower ceiling on it than some others, but I do think he's got a shot to be a successful coach there.
Yeah, I don't think that Bielema will be a bad coach in Illinois. I think his record is actually that he's a good coach. I just question, like, at Wisconsin, he took over a pretty ready-made program in 2006. Barry Alvarez's fingerprints are still all over the Wisconsin program. I mean, if you run what Barry Alvarez ran at Wisconsin, yeah, for whatever reason, it seems like it still works out. It's almost like Barry Alvarez is actually kind of the shadow coach, if you will. And I mean, like, there are kind of whispers about that in the industry, not that he's coaching at practice or anything like that, but that he's, you know, he's not pulling the Fulmer, but that he's still very involved and it's set up to succeed. In fact, the only guy that really didn't have great success there was somebody who was trying to do something kind of different, and that was Gary Anderson. And he seems to have his own, you know, list of issues. My question is, is Brett as good of a coach if he doesn't have the talent advantage? And this is kind of the second straight job where everybody you play in a given year in your division is going to be out recruiting you, I think, or pretty close. Same thing at Arkansas and the SEC West. Like, the only team that you really recruit with on par is Mississippi State. Ole Miss, A&M, LSU, Bama, Auburn are all going to have more talent than you on a year-to-year basis. But I think this can work. That's why I'm in the get-it camp. It does concern me a little bit that I wonder if their AD is just going for big names at times as opposed to the guy who could be the best coach, because he went and got Lovie Smith.
Did Whitman hire Lovie Smith?
Yeah.
He did, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that very much reeked of, like, oh, look at this name I got.
Yeah.
And I think that is a mistake in coaching hires, for sure.
Kind of like the guy who hired Les Miles at Arkansas, or excuse me, at Kansas.
For sure.
The same guy who hired Bielema at Arkansas.
Yeah. Oh, look at me walking into town. Like, look at this guy I'm about to pull for y'all. And it's just not men. Like, that ain't it. That's not how you turn this thing around.
Culturally, though, I mean, Bielema, what he has the Hawkeye tattoo. He knows the area. He knows the region. I think he could recruit relative to his division. I think he can recruit better at Illinois than he could recruit at Arkansas. I think it'll be fine. I don't know what is success at Illinois. I guess is an interesting question here.
Bowls, probably,
a bowl game.
Right? Sure. I mean, you can't expect that much more. I mean, look, they've had their moments of. And I think within those moments, they're recruiting really well in Chicago area. And I do, like, Brett Bielema right off the jump has apparently, like, called the head of the Illinois High School Football Association. And he's, like, making, like, that was, like, one of the first things he did.
Checking some boxes here.
Yeah, like, he's making sure that in-state recruiting is a significant priority. But yeah, I think bowls, just bowls, is kind of all you really need to hit.
Well, from Illinois to another team that wears similar colors and where bowls are not acceptable. Auburn does not have a head coach as of Monday morning at about 10:20 Eastern time. As we get further and further away from the firing, I have more doubts that Kevin Steele is going to get this job. I don't think that you fire Gus Malzahn to wait 2 weeks and then hire Kevin Steele.
Yeah, I mean, that it seems like that was seems like the boosters wanted that, and the boosters almost got their man like right out of the gate, it sounded like, and then cooler heads, or however you want to phrase it, pumped the brakes, made sure they went through their due diligence. And it seems, based on the reporting of folks in the know, including Auburn Undercover, our 24/7 Sports Auburn site, is doing a great job with this deal. Seems like Billy Napier is emerging as potentially a favorite or the lead dog, maybe. In fact, Kevin Steele, the reports coming out today, or Kevin Steele is just flat out. So Billy Napier, who allegedly, like, I don't, depend on who you ask, South Carolina picked Shane Beamer over him, or he turned down South Carolina. Either way, if Billy Napier manages to get this gig, he played his cards right. Because I think Auburn is a better gig than South Carolina.
It could also be that Napier didn't push hard for the South Carolina job, and maybe
kind of knew in the back of his head, like, I want it, but maybe this isn't my best interview because I've got some reservations deep down.
Pruitt's losing games on the regular at Tennessee. Auburn could open, you know, heck, what if LSU goes completely sideways here in my own state? So maybe South Carolina did pick Shane Beamer over him, but maybe Napier didn't give them a lot to like, you know, potentially. That could be a third option there.
Right.
My first thought here is we are seeing a positive impact, I think, of the transfer portal, because we're not seeing teams wait until after National Signing Day as much to fire their head coaches in order to lock in these recruits. Because now if you do this, A, I think the public pressure to let these kids out of their letters of intent has never been greater. And B, if you do double cross them and you fire the head coach just a couple days after signing day, they're just like, all right, peace, I'm transferring. You know, I'm going to go. So like that was kind of the first thing that popped in my head. I pulled up Auburn's recruiting ranking. They're 41st in the country. They only have 13 kids, so they're going to add a couple more to the class, both from the high school, JUCO, and the transfer portal. But that's kind of a cool impact this year. You're not going to see, I don't think, quite as much head coach firings, you know, post early signing period, given the transfer portal. Napier knows how the game is played. If it is going to be Napier, he has worked for Saban. He's worked at Clemson. He's recruited in the Southeast. He's, I believe, been a play caller to the extent you think that's important. He's also been a head coach, which I think is more important than having been a play caller. He knows how to recruit. He's not won a conference title, I think, but gone to the conference title game a couple times now. Although I guess they share it with Coastal this year, technically, because the game got canceled.
Technically, yeah, even though Coastal beat them.
Yeah, that's kind of weak sauce. But still, I think Napier is doing a really good job there at Louisiana. He's thought of highly in the industry. He's a very motivated recruiter. He's an organized guy. I think this could be a really good hire for them, if that's who it is.
I'm a believer in Napier. I think he's the right mix. And I feel like I've said this a few times, so sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I think he's the right mix of new school, old school. He's got the Saban blueprint. He knows the way a high-level program should operate. He knows about player development, strength and conditioning. He knows about recruiting at the highest level. And yet I think he also understands and has the Dabo approach ingrained in him as well. The, like, you know what? This is going to be a place that coaches want to work. This is going to be an atmosphere that's positive. This is going to be a family environment, more so than like the business cutthroat approach that maybe you might find elsewhere. And so I like the balance that he brings. I mean, it's a very enticing picture presented as Dabo and Saban, these sort of dual impacts from a formative standpoint on his coaching. Like, why wouldn't, like, what's not appealing about that? And he's an offensive guy. And so he is bringing his offense with him. And I think that's always comforting to know that, like, you're not going to be at the mercy of offensive coordinators leaving every year. Auburn would have liked that under Gus Malzahn, instead of having the Gus Malzahn hand on the offense forever, eternally. But I think Billy Napier is a little more adaptive than that.
I would agree. Let's remember what Auburn defines success as here. The reason I was told that they fired Gus was that they didn't think they had any momentum. They were losing ground recruiting the state of Georgia, and they were losing important battles like George Pickens, Justin Ross. Auburn was going to evaluate Billy Napier or whomever they hire based on his ability to get the right assistant coaches around him, based on his ability to organize the boosters and be quote unquote all in the recruiting process. And we all know what that means. And, get their fair share of kids out of Georgia, not allow Saban and Kirby to have right of first refusal on every big time kid, and, not lose quite as many battles to Clemson. And now LSU in Mobile and areas like that. So that's a tough task, but Gus got paid $20 million or however much, 24 or whatever it was, because he wasn't quite up to their standards. I'm not going to give a grade on this yet, because I want to hear a little more about Napier and what the kind of plans are yet.
Yeah, no grade. The protocol is no grades until the hire goes final. It's a standard operating protocol that we've held ourselves to. But I mean, hell, this whole thing could, who knows what kind of twists and turns we still got in front of us.
I mean, we could end up with anybody. Maybe someone from the NFL. Who knows? How much time we got left here?
I think we got it covered, man.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's go ahead and do a mailbag episode next time. And we'll also break down the playoff games, and that'll kind of get us through the new year. Normally we'd have episodes on what are we doing at the Army All-America or the All-America Bowl. And this year that's canceled. So a little bit less info coming out for us to talk about. So we'll focus a little more on football than recruiting. 5 stars on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. If you guys got it, make sure you're hitting the subscribe button. Also on Spotify and Google Podcast and basically wherever else you get your podcast. Tell your friends, grab your wife's phone, your husband's phone. Also give us 5 stars on there. Let's get us to 800 for the new year. That'd be pretty cool for a first year show. So, all right.
Later.
It's the NFL offseason, but on Pick 6, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, the football season never stops. Host Will Brinson, John Breach, and Tyler Sullivan are joined by analysts like Brady Quinn, Leslie Deuceable, Katie Mox, and RJ White to keep you in the loop on everything happening around the league. Whether it's free agents signing with new teams, the all-important NFL draft, or schedule release day, Pick 6 has you covered. As the face of the league changes with every team move and player pickup this spring, Pick 6 is a must listen. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and anywhere podcasts are found.